knew the answer, and after they showered together, they dressed and packed. Stepping out the door, they saw Wright sitting in the folding chair. "Would you two mind if we get a cup of coffee?" he asked. "For starters," Wright began, "your apartment has been cleared for re-entry. Forensics left earlier this morning and they're done. I figured you'd want to know in case you needed to grab anything, clothes or toiletries or whatever."
If there's anything left that I even want, Maria thought. Did they find anything?
No clear evidence was left behind except for the paint cans, and there were no fingerprints on those. Atkinson must have worn gloves. As for hair samples, that'll take a little longer, but no guarantees. Hair sample analysis is always tricky, unless there's DNA from the root.
Maria nodded, trying to force away the images she'd seen the night before.
"I also made some other calls this morning," Wright said, stirring sugar and cream into his coffee. Maria noted the bags under his bloodshot eyes. "As of yet, no one has been able to talk to Lester. He hadn't been at the station for 10 minutes before his attorney showed up, and a short while after that, his father appeared too and made the same demands that the attorney was making. Not that they were able to talk to him either. By then, Lester Manning was strapped to a gurney in the infirmary on psychiatric hold, and he's still sedated. The general consensus is that he's nuttier than an almond tree. According to the officers, as soon as he saw the cell, he went bonkers."
"How so?"
"Screaming, fighting with the officers, trying to bite the officers. And once they got him in there, he started kicking at the doors, banging his head on the wall, crazy stuff. He even scared the other prisoners, so he had to be moved out. A doctor was called in who gave him something to calm him down. It took 5 officers to restrain him, and that was when the attorney showed up. He's claiming all sorts of civil rights violations, but it's all on camera, so no one's worried about Lester having some sort of case that might spring him. I wanted you to know that right up front. That's not going to happen, no matter what his attorney might say. He shot a cop. Anyway, the point is, no one's been able to talk to him yet."
Maria nodded, feeling numb. "How's
Pete?" Wright asked. "He made it through the night. He's still in critical condition, but he's stable for now, and his vitals are improving. His wife is hopeful that he'll regain consciousness sometime today. The surgeon said it was possible, but we're still in a wait-and-see mode on that front. Rachel was able to spend some time with him this morning. They're boys, too. Of course, it was scary for them. They're only 9 and 11, and he's their hero, you know. After coffee, I'll head over there, see if I can sit with him a bit. Or at the very least, sit with Rachel."
When Maria didn't respond, Wright rotated his coffee cup in place.
"I also looked into the car that was at the bungalow. I remember seeing it too, and to answer the question from last night, the Shallot police did not impound the vehicle, nor did the sheriff's department, which means that Atkinson showed up after the police had left to retrieve it."
"Maybe," Colin said.
"Maybe?" Wright asked. "He may have been there all along. Maybe he ducked out the back when Evan and I were trying to save Margolis. He hid out for a while, then came back. That also might explain how Margolis got shot in the first place. He went in expecting one person and then was surprised by 2.
Wright studied Colin.
"When Pete talked about you," he said, "I didn't get the sense he liked you very much."
"I don't like him either."
Wright raised an eyebrow.
"Then why did you save him?"
"He didn't deserve to die."
Wright turned to Maria.
"Is he always like this?"
"Yes," she answered with a wry smile, then switched gears. "I still don't see how or why Lester and Atkinson are working together to target me."
"There's more," he said, lifting his palm to stop her. "That's the other thing I wanted to talk to you about. I spoke to the detective in Charlotte that Pete was working with. His name's Tony Roberts, by the way. And when I filled him in on what happened to Pete, he told me that Pete had called him yesterday, but that he hadn't been able to check out Atkinson yet. Of course, this put the request on a whole new level, and he called Atkinson's mother, picked her up, and went to Atkinson's apartment. She was able to convince the manager to let him in. There's still a missing persons report on file, even if up until now, no one had believed her, and she's the next of kin.
The point is, she was more than happy to let Roberts help find her son, and I guess that when Roberts got there, he hit the jackpot. It just wasn't in the way the mom wanted. It turns out that Atkinson's laptop was still there, and Roberts was able to access it.
And?
He looked at Maria. He had files about you. Tons of information. Background information, school records, information about your family, where you live and work, your daily schedule. He even had information about Colin in there. Photographs, too.
He had photographs?
Hundreds. Walking, at the store, on the paddleboard. Even while you were working. It seems he's been watching and following you for quite a long time. Spying on you. Roberts removed the laptop as evidence over Mrs. Atkinson's sudden, vehement protests. As soon as she saw what was on it, she tried to withdraw her consent to enter the place, but by then it was too late, and Roberts had it in hand. Defense lawyers would likely raise a stink, but there was a missing persons report. She gave her consent, and the evidence was in plain sight. Roberts, though, was better than that. He let me know he'd actually recorded her saying that she wanted him to access the computer. With that said, once we get Lester to talk, it'll probably be a moot point anyway. Lawyer or not, he'll end up talking. The crazy ones usually end up spilling everything, especially once they get lucid, because guilt sets in. Maria wasn't sure that was true, but
why does Atkinson want to hurt me?
That part, I can't answer with certainty. I can tell you there was information about Cassie Manning on the laptop, too, but you're already aware of that link.
Do you have any idea where Atkinson is now?
No. We have an APB out on him, but since no one seems to know where he's been, I'm not sure how much good that will do. Again, I'm hoping that Lester will be able to tell us more, but when that will be is still up in the air. It might take a day, it might take a few days, it might take a week, and then we'll still have to deal with the attorney and his father, both of whom will tell him not to answer any questions at all. Which raises the question of where you want to be for the next few days. If I were you, I'm not sure I'd hang around Wilmington.
I'm supposed to go to my parents today, she said. I'm sure I'll be fine.
Wright looked dubious. It's your call, he said. Just be careful. From what Roberts was telling me, Atkinson is not only dangerous, he's probably just as crazy as Lester. So let me give you my phone number. I want you to call me if anything strikes you as out of the ordinary or something else comes to you. Okay? If Wright's intent had been to scare her, it had worked. But after last night, Maria was going to be afraid no matter what until Atkinson was finally caught. They got in the car, and as Colin set out toward her parents, he reached for his phone.
Who are you calling?
Evan, he said. I want to see if he's busy today.
Why?
Because after I drop you off at your parents', I'd like to go back to your place. Now that the police have cleared it, I want to get it cleaned up, maybe do some painting.
You don't have to do that.
I know, he said. But I want to. You don't need that kind of reminder when you go home. And I'd probably end up going stir crazy just sitting around.
But it'll take all day.
Not that long. A few hours, maybe. Your place isn't that big.
Maybe I should go with you. It's not your responsibility.
You don't need that kind of stress. And besides, you should be with your family. He had a point, and it was a kind thing to offer. But she was about to say no when he turned toward her. Please, he said. I want to do this. It was his tone that allowed her to reluctantly agree, and Colin made the call, putting it on speaker. She probably shouldn't have been surprised that Lily answered Evan's phone. Colin told her what had happened the night before and asked if Evan might be able to help him carry out some of the heavier furniture. Before he even finished, Lily had cut him off.
We'll both be there. Do not even think of asking us not to come. We had nothing on our agenda this afternoon anyway. We'd be thrilled to help.
In the background, Maria heard Evan's voice.
Help with what? We're going to clean up Maria's apartment, and I have the cutest shorts I've been dying to wear. They're a little short and kind of tight, but this seems like the perfect opportunity.
In the background, Evan was silent for a beat.
What time are we going?
When they hung up, Maria looked over at Colin.
I like your friends.
They are pretty great, he agreed.
Two blocks before they reached her parents' neighborhood, the meaning of Serena's message became clear. Her uncle Tito was in the park, kicking a soccer ball with her uncle Jose and a few of her nieces and nephews, and when both of her uncles waved, she knew that what they were really doing was keeping watch. Meanwhile, Pedro, Juan, and Angelo, her cousins, were positioned in lawn chairs on the front lawn, and some of her younger cousins were in the street playing kickball. Cars she recognized lined the road on either side all the way to the corner.
My God, she thought, my entire extended family is here.
And though she'd been through hell in the last few days, she couldn't help but smile. Despite Colin's reluctance, she dragged him into the house. 30 or 40 people milled around inside. There were another 20 in the backyard, men and women, boys and girls. Serena came rushing forward.
Crazy, huh? Dad actually closed the restaurant today. Can you believe that?
I don't think we needed everyone to come.
He didn't ask them to, she said. Everyone just showed up when they found out you might be in trouble. I'm sure the neighbors wondered what on earth was going on, but Dad went around and explained that we were having a family reunion. After today, there will always be a family watch patrol in the neighborhood until Atkinson is behind bars, but they'll be more subtle about it. They've decided to organize shifts.
For me?
Serena smiled.
That's how we roll.
It took Colin almost half an hour to extract himself. Everyone wanted to meet him, even if many of the greetings were in Spanish. As Maria walked him back to the car, she reflected that, despite everything, she was blessed.
I still think I should go with you, she said.
I doubt your parents would let you leave.
Probably not, she agreed. I'm sure my dad is watching from the window right now, just in case.
Then I guess I'm not allowed to kiss you.
You better, she said. And make sure you bring Evan and Lily back here for dinner, okay? I want the rest of my family to meet them too.
Colin didn't make it back to the house until 5:30. Some family members had left, but most had stayed. For her part, Lily was perfectly at ease the moment she stepped out of the car, even if Colin and Evan seemed a bit uncertain.
What a wonderful show of solidarity and love,
Lily pronounced with a hug as soon as Maria walked up.
I simply can't wait to meet each and every member of your wonderful family.
Lily's southern-tinged Spanish delighted everyone she met the same way it had charmed Maria. And as the relatives crowded around her and Evan, Maria pulled Colin away and stepped onto the back porch.
How did it go?
She asked. I'll need to put a final coat of paint on the wall, but the primer was able to cover up the spray paint. We got rid of everything broken and set aside the stuff that might be able to be cleaned. I'm not sure there's much we can do about your clothes, though. When she nodded, he went on. Did you hear any updates on Margolis? Or have you heard from Atkinson?
No, she answered. I've been checking my phone for messages all day.
He looked around. Where's Serena?
She left a few minutes before you got here. She has that interview tonight, and she had to get ready.
Maria reached for his hand.
You look tired.
I'm okay.
It was more work than you expected, wasn't it?
No, he said. But it was hard for me to keep my anger in check.
Yeah, she said. For me too.
After making the rounds with the family, Lily and Evan joined Colin and Maria at the table on the porch.
Thanks for cleaning up my place, Maria said.
It was no problem at all,
Lily said.
And I must say it's an absolutely charming location. Evan and I considered moving downtown as well, but Evan insisted that he couldn't imagine having no lawn to mow.
I don't do that now, Evan said. Colin does it. I hate mowing the lawn.
Hush now,
she said.
I was just teasing. But you should know that physical labor can be quite attractive in a man.
What do you think I was doing today?
My point exactly, she said. You cut a very appealing figure as you were moving furniture, you know.
The door to the porch opened and Carmen came out carrying place settings for each of them. followed by several plates of food that occupied more than half the table. Not only had the kitchen been hopping all day, but most of the relatives had brought food as well.
"I hope you're hungry," Carmen said in English.
It was too much food, just like always. While Colin seemed to have expected it, both Evan and Lily looked overwhelmed.
"This is great, Mom," Maria said, suddenly grateful for her mother's wordless demonstration of love.
"I love you."
Chapter 31. Colin. After dinner, Colin wandered out to the front yard, seeking some time alone. A pair of uncles sat in lawn chairs overlooking the street, nodding at Colin's polite salute. Reflexively, he relived the destruction he'd seen at Maria's house, trying to piece together its connection to Atkinson and Lester. Lester and Atkinson had once worked together, and Lester had introduced Atkinson to his sister. And while Maria believed that Lester had been sending messages to her, Dr. Manning suggested that Atkinson was responsible. It was uncanny timing that Atkinson had disappeared shortly before Maria's stalking began. Presumably, Atkinson had slashed Maria's tires. But which of the two had killed Coppo? Lester shot Margolis. Atkinson removed the car from the bungalow and later trashed Maria's place. Given the trove of information found on Atkinson's computer, his involvement in Maria's stalking seemed clear-cut. But certain details continued to bother Colin. Dr. Manning had mentioned an argument between Lester and Atkinson and said they'd had a falling out. But when had they regained each other's trust? Which one was in charge? Why had Dr. Manning insisted that Atkinson was trying to frame Lester when it seemed clear they had to be working together? And if they were working together, why drive two cars to the Sanchez house the night Lester attacked Maria? And yet, as Colin had cleaned Maria's condo, he'd thought back on the earlier conversation with Detective Wright and realized that there was no evidence conclusively linking Atkinson to the trashing of the condo yet. There wasn't any conclusive evidence supporting the idea that he'd slashed Maria's tires either. Despite the content found on his computer, Maria had never interacted with him or even seen him. She'd said all along that Atkinson's involvement never felt plausible to her, which meant... what? Suppose Atkinson really had gone off to meet a woman. And what if Lester knew that Atkinson would be out of town? Lester could have planted the information on Atkinson's computer and taken Atkinson's car while he was away. Lester could have, as Maria pointed out the night before, easily paid someone to slash Maria's tires, maybe even trash her condo. It would be the perfect setup, as long as you believed that Lester was capable of such intricate planning. Based on the behavior that Colin had witnessed at the bungalow, and the way Wright had described Lester's actions at the station, that felt unlikely. And since Atkinson had apparently driven Lester back to Shalott after he'd shown up at the Sanchez's, Atkinson had to have been nearby. They had to be working together, and Colin supposed that Lester must have been spooked by the sirens. Atkinson must have heard them too, fueling his own panic, and he'd picked Lester up before racing the two of them out of the neighborhood. They would have been driving fast and possibly as recklessly as Colin had, but in the opposite direction. Like the car Colin had almost hit just blocks from the Sanchez's home? Colin felt something akin to a key turning in a lock and strained to remember exactly what he'd seen. The car careening toward him, swerving in the last instant, the vehicles brushing past with only inches to spare. Two men in the front seat. What kind of car? A Camry. Blue. Reaching for his phone, he called Detective Wright, who answered on the second ring. "Have you heard anything about Margolis?" Colin asked. "Improving, or so they say. Still in critical care and still unconscious. How are things there?"
"They're okay. Maria's safe."
"And tonight?"
"She'll stay here. She's well protected."
"If you say so. What do you need?"
"I'm thinking that Atkinson might be driving a blue Camry, relatively new."
"Why do you think that?"
Colin outlined his reasoning.
"You wouldn't have happened to have gotten a license plate, would you?"
No.
Okay. It's not much, but I'll get the word out. Everyone wants to find this guy. The sooner the better.
Colin disconnected, somehow sure that Lester had been in the Blue Camry that night. He felt certain, even if he couldn't explain the reason, other than to assume that his subconscious mind was somehow ahead of his conscious mind and understanding that the answers were there, if only he could find them.
What are you doing out here?
Evan asked, joining Colin in the front yard.
Thinking, Colin answered.
It was 6:30 and dusk had given way to darkness, the autumn air hinting at even cooler temperatures as the evening wore on.
I figured. I saw the smoke drifting out of your ears.
Colin smiled.
I just got off the phone with Detective Wright, he explained, recapping the conversation. What are you doing out here?
As sweet as Carmen is, her food is kind of spicy. Lily asked me to get her some gum from the glove compartment to help cool down her mouth. If you ask me, Lily just wants her breath to smell minty fresh, because not having minty fresh breath isn't ladylike.
He shrugged.
By the way, what do you make of all this? Maria's family, I mean.
I think they're great.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Her entire extended family showing up to keep her safe?
Colin nodded.
I doubt even my immediate family would show up.
Evan raised an eyebrow.
Don't kid yourself. When things were bad, even your family circled the wagons.
Friends, too, Colin said. Thanks for your help today. I know you wanted to spend the day in bed with Lily.
You're welcome, Evan shrugged. But it wasn't going to work out anyway. I couldn't stop thinking about Margolis, which kind of put a damper on my mood. I still can't figure out how he let Lester get the jump on him.
Colin paused.
When he was on the porch, did he look confused to you?
He looked pissed off, Evan said, because we hadn't left yet.
How did he look before that?
I have no idea, dude,
Evan said, shaking his head.
Everything is so jumbled. I'm not really sure what happened. I can remember hearing shots and seeing you doing your crazy thing, but after that, it's just all blood. My brain's so scrambled, I can't even remember why I came out here in the first place.
You came out here to get Lily some gum, Colin reminded him.
Oh yeah, that's right. Minty freshness.
Evan started toward the car and then turned around to look back at Colin.
Do you want a piece?
No, Colin said. But Dr. Manning probably would.
Colin wasn't sure why Margolis's description of Manning's compulsive gum chewing leaped to mind. But after considering it, he shook his head, deciding to head back inside with Evan and rejoin Maria's family. They were a marvel, he had to admit. Talk about circling the wagons. In times of crisis, family was sometimes all you really had. Hell, even Dr. Manning showed up for Lester. He'd spoken to Margolis. He'd shown up at the station. He'd also immediately arranged for an attorney since Lester had been in no condition to do so himself. How had Dr. Manning even known of Lester's arrest? Wright had said that the attorney had shown up 10 minutes after Lester had arrived at the station. Colin knew from experience that it was almost impossible to procure an attorney that quickly, especially on a Friday night after business hours, which meant that Dr. Manning had known that Lester had been arrested well before his arrival at the station. It was almost like he was there and had parked his car in the driveway? No, Colin thought. Margolis would have recognized the car. He'd seen Dr. Manning's car yesterday morning when the doctor had shown Margolis the gun in the trunk. And if it had been Dr. Manning's car at the bungalow, Margolis probably would have acted confused? Colin stopped in his tracks. No, it wasn't possible, but family circle the wagons. Son and father. Lester and Dr. Manning. Dr. Manning nervously mowing through a pack of gum while talking to Margolis. Colin groped for the answer, a forgotten detail, and hadn't he noticed a bunch of gum wrappers strewn on the roof of the building across from Maria's office? Colin could barely breathe. It wasn't Atkinson and Lester. It was father and son circling the wagons, and all at once, the answer started cascading through his mind as quickly as Colin could form the questions. Why hadn't Margolis been more cautious at the bungalow?
because he saw that Avery Manning, the father, was already there. And Lester's gun? Dr. Manning had told Margolis the gun likely wasn't real. Why had Margolis gone inside? Because Dr. Manning called out to him, assuring Margolis that everything was okay. It fit. It all fit, he thought, clarity finally emerging. But Lester was arrested. Only because Colin was there to take him down, otherwise Lester might have escaped. But Lester might talk. The attorney Dr. Manning hired would make sure he didn't. But Dr. Manning had left a message for Margolis urging him to warn Maria after the fact, too late to matter. And Atkinson? The man who failed to intervene when Laws abducted Cassie, whom Dr. Manning might feel deserves to be punished as well? But Atkinson's laptop, the photos, the files, all of which made Atkinson the perfect fall guy. By then, Colin was already reaching for his phone, the truth so obvious that he wasn't sure how he could have missed it. Who had the knowledge and skill necessary to manipulate Lester? Dr. Manning, the psychiatrist. How had Atkinson's name come up in the first place? Dr. Manning. And Laws' pattern of stalking Cassie? Dr. Manning knew every detail. Colin heard a voice on the other end of the phone. Wright sounding busy and stressed.
You again, Wright said. What's up?
Check to see if Dr. Manning owns a blue Camry. Wright hesitated.
Hold on. Why?
Have someone check it out while I talk, Colin said. Just do it. It's important. After he heard Wright call out the request to another officer, Colin told him everything. When he finished, Wright was quiet for a moment.
That sounds a little far-fetched, don't you think? Wright said. But if you're right, Margolis will be able to clear all this up as soon as he regains consciousness. Besides,
Wright seemed to be wrestling with his own doubts.
Yes? It's not as though Dr. Manning is trying to hide. Far from it. He was at the station last night, and he was at the hospital today.
He was there? Colin asked, feeling a mounting sense of panic.
He spoke with Rachel. He wanted to apologize for what his son did and asked if it might be possible to speak with Pete so he could apologize to him too.
Don't let him near Margolis, Colin shouted, panic giving way to fear.
Keep it down, Wright said. Manning couldn't see him. Even I couldn't see him. Only family is allowed in the ICU.
Manning went there to kill him, Colin interrupted. He's a medical doctor. He'd know what to do to make the death look natural.
Don't you think you're jumping to conclusions?
Lester didn't shoot Margolis, Dr. Manning did. Lester had Margolis squarely in his sights, but he couldn't pull the trigger. If you don't believe me, test Lester's hands for gunpowder residue.
That won't tell us anything. It's too late. Those tests get less effective by the hour.
I know I'm right about this.
Wright was silent for a long moment. Okay, but what about Atkinson's computer?
Atkinson is dead, Colin said with sudden certainty. Dr. Manning killed him. Made it look like he went on a trip, took his car, planted evidence on the computer, made him the prime suspect and planned it all.
Wright said nothing. After a moment of silence, Colin heard the muffled sound of the detective speaking with someone else.
Colin felt his frustration rising until Wright came back on the line, sounding slightly stunned.
Dr. Manning, Wright said slowly, owns a blue Camry. And I gotta go. I want to verify that the Camry was at the bungalow.
Wright hung up mid-sentence. Colin raced inside to update Maria, finding her still on the back porch with Evan and Lily, her parents and a scattering of aunts and uncles. As Colin related his discoveries, Maria listened silently. By the end, her eyes were closed, and though the revelations were clearly frightening to her, he also sensed a kind of peace in her at finally knowing the truth. Her relatives, meanwhile, remained silent, all of them waiting for her to respond.
Okay, Maria finally said. What's next?
I'm guessing Wright will put out an APB on Dr. Manning, and then do whatever else it is cops do when searching for a suspect and building a case.
Maria thought about that.
But what about the pattern? She finally ventured. I mean, if Dr. Manning wanted me to experience everything Laws had done to Cassie, Why would he have vandalized my place last night? He had to know that would make it even more difficult to get to me. And why didn't Lester grab me when he had the chance to beat me? Maybe burn me alive and then kill himself? She didn't need to add.
Colin remembered what Laws had done, but knew that Dr. Manning had never planned to kill himself. He'd wanted Atkinson's body found in the ashes, which would close the case for good, leaving Dr. Manning a free man. All Colin could do was shake his head.
I don't know, he admitted.
7 o'clock now, and the night was growing even darker, with just a sliver of moon above the horizon. As the family, led by Felix, began making additional plans to keep Maria safe, Colin drifted to the kitchen and retrieved a glass from the cupboard. He was thirsty, but he also wanted to be alone while he pondered Maria's questions. Moving to the refrigerator, he set the glass under the dispenser. Filling it with water, he downed the glass in a single long pull and began refilling it, his eyes absently scanning the refrigerator door. There were photos of Maria and Serena over the years, poems, Maria's confirmation certificate, and a drawing of a rainbow in crayon with Serena's name carefully etched in the corner. Some of the items had begun to yellow at the edges, and the only recent addition appeared to be the letter Serena had received from the Charles Alexander Foundation. It was in the upper corner, partially obscuring a postcard that displayed the Metropolitan Cathedral in Mexico City. As Colin glanced at the letterhead, he was again nagged by the thought that the name seemed oddly familiar. Still, Maria's questions had left him feeling unsettled. Why had Dr. Manning vandalized her condo? If Dr. Manning wanted Maria to experience everything Cassie had, then why deviate from the pattern now? And why paint the words, "You will know how it feels," in her bedroom, when doing so only made her more inaccessible? It was possible, he supposed, that Dr. Manning had panicked or lost control after Lester had been arrested. Colin wanted to believe that, tried to force himself to, but couldn't quite make that leap. Instead, he felt like he'd overlooked something. Either he was missing a piece of the puzzle, or Dr. Manning no longer cared whether he could get to Maria at all. But why wouldn't he care? Turning from the fridge, he took another drink, consoling himself with the notion that even without the answers, not only was Maria safe, but she'd remain safe until Dr. Manning was apprehended. Colin and her family would make sure of that. They gave circling the wagons a whole new meaning. Hell, all of them were here right now, standing watch. But in that instant, he realized he was wrong. Not all of them were here. One of them was missing. And Dr. Manning no longer cared whether he could get to Maria at all. Because Maria had never been part of Dr. Manning's endgame in the first place. In Colin's mind, the answers began to tumble fast, clarity emerging. The name on the letterhead and why it seemed so familiar. Why Maria's place had been trashed. How Lester had known about Carmen's birthday. The real meaning behind the words that had been painted in the bedroom. You will know how it feels. Dropping the glass, Colin burst from the kitchen, through the living room, and down the short hallway into Maria's bedroom. He located her bags and spotted her laptop in her tote bag. Grabbing it, he flipped up the lid, thinking, no, 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 please God, let me be wrong about this. He opened the search program and typed in the name of the foundation that had awarded Serena's scholarship. Wanted to see it, prayed for it to come up. No website displayed. Just a notice saying the site had been taken down and that the domain name was available. No, no, no. He typed in Avery Manning's name and recognized the same links he'd perused after he and Maria had met with Margolis the first time. He remembered the link that had included Avery Manning's photograph and clicked on it even as he rushed back to the living room. Looking up, he spotted Carmen, but not Felix. Carmen! He shouted, hoping she'd be able to understand what he was about to say. Relatives turned his way, alarmed. Colin ignored them, ignored Carmen's sudden expression of fright. From the corner of his eye, he saw the backslider opening, Maria about to enter. By then, he'd reached Carmen. He held up the computer and was pointing to the photograph.
Do you recognize him? Colin said, talking loud and fast, fear now building to panic. Is this the man who came to the house for dinner? Is this the director of the foundation? Carmen began shaking her head.
No sé. No entiendo. Habla más despacio, por favor.
What's going on? Maria cried. What are you doing, Colin? You're scaring her.
It's him, Colin shouted.
Who?
Maria yelled, his fear contagious.
What's happening?
By then, Felix had come rushing through the slider too, followed by Evan and Lily, more relatives.
Look at him, Colin said to Carmen, pointing to the photograph, lowering his voice, trying and failing to sound calm. Look at the photo. The director. Is this him? Is this who came to your house for dinner?
Mira la foto, mamá,
Maria translated, moving next to her.
¿Es esto el director de la fundación? ¿Quién vino a la casa para la cena?
Carmen's eyes swiveled in terror between Colin and Maria before she leaned in to scrutinize the photo on the screen. After a moment, she began nodding quickly.
Sí,
Carmen said, seemingly on the verge of tears.
Charles Alexander. Él es el director. Él estaba aquí en la casa.
Colin,
Maria yelled, grabbing his arm. He turned his panicked gaze on her.
Where's Serena? He demanded. Where is she?
At the interview, you know that. What's wrong?
Where's the interview? Where is it taking place?
I don't know. I guess at the foundation's office.
Where's the office? Colin shouted.
Downtown, on the waterfront, Maria stammered. The older commercial area, not the historic district. Tell me what's happening.
Abandoned buildings, Colin thought. Foreclosed buildings. Fire.
Thoughts falling as fast as shuffling cards. Dr. Manning no longer caring whether he could get to Maria. Maria needing to know how it feels. Because it wasn't only about making Maria experience Cassie's terror. It was about punishing Maria. Making her feel the same way Dr. Manning and Lester felt after someone they loved had been murdered. Oh, God.
Call the police, Colin shouted. Call 911.
Colin, Maria screamed. Talk to me.
Avery Manning pretended to be Charles Alexander, Colin shouted, feeling the clock was ticking and knowing there wasn't time to explain everything. Dr. Manning had a child named Alexander Charles. There is no foundation or scholarship. Dr. Manning made it up, he hissed. You weren't the target. Serena's the target. She's with him right now, and I need to know exactly where she is before.
Maria understood everything in an instant, her expression stricken as Colin grabbed her hand and pulled her along with him, racing for the door that led to the garage. He vaguely heard Maria screaming,
Llame a la policía! Emergencia! Llame a 911!
Over her shoulder as they burst from the garage, racing to his car. Maria dove in and Colin was rounding the car when he heard Evan shouting that they were coming too. Colin jumped behind the wheel, barking out instructions for Maria to call Detective Wright. He turned the key hard, gunning the engine, his tires screeching as he tore away from the house. In the rearview mirror, he vaguely noticed headlights turning on, Evan and Lily and various relatives trailing in his wake.
When did Serena say she had the interview?
Colin demanded, even as Maria was waiting for Wright to answer her call.
I can't remember. 7, maybe?
What's the address?
I picked her up at the office once, but I don't know.
Colin pressed the accelerator to the floor and the engine roared, the car shuddering as it rounded the first curve. Colin, fighting the thought that he might already be too late, cursing himself for not figuring it out sooner. The headlights in the rearview mirror grew smaller as the speedometer nosed toward 70 and then 80. He slammed on the brakes, skidding onto the main road to the screech of an oncoming car's tires. Undeterred, he sped up again, only dimly aware that Maria was screaming into the phone at Detective Wright. Colin continued to accelerate, surging close to 100 miles an hour, feeling deja vu as he swerved into the bike lane and slowing but not stopping for red lights. He leaned on his horn, flashed his lights, and cut through parking lots as precious seconds ticked by. Maria had hung up with Detective Wright and was now frantically dialing and redialing, her actions growing even more panicked.
Serena's not answering her phone.
Find out when she left the dorm, Colin shouted.
But how?
I don't know. Colin changed lanes, ran another red light, and checked the rearview mirror. Evan's headlights were too far behind to see anymore, and Colin squeezed the steering wheel, furious with himself for being so stupid, for missing the obvious. Thinking about Serena, telling himself that he'd get there in time to save her. He'd get there. He had to get there. Charles Alexander, Alexander Charles. He'd seen the name on the computer, and the connection was right there on the refrigerator in the damn letterhead. And Serena had even said the name at dinner. It was obvious, and Colin couldn't understand why it had taken him so long to put it together. If something happened to Serena because he'd been so damn stupid. Colin vaguely heard Maria shout the name Steve into the phone. Heard her demanding to know when Serena had left. Heard her say that Serena was running late and had left at 6:40. What time is it? Colin demanded, speeding so fast he was unable to take his eyes from the road for a second. Check your phone.
7:12.
Serena might not have arrived yet. Or she was there already. Colin pressed his teeth together, his jaw muscles pulsing, thinking that if anything had happened to her, he'd hunt Dr. Manning to the ends of the earth. The man deserved to die, and in that instant, Colin's thoughts began narrowing as he felt a visceral, almost tangible urge to kill him. In his ever-growing rage, the speedometer topped 120, and all Colin could think was go, go, go. Chapter 32. Maria. Colin was driving so fast that the images beyond the windows were blurry. Despite the seatbelt, Maria was being flung from side to side whenever he made a turn or braked or accelerated. And yet all she could think about was Serena and that she'd been the target all along. And he'd toyed with her. The fake scholarship, interviews, slowly earning her trust. But all the while he'd been planning, following Serena, stalking. Not just in person, but on Serena's social media too. He'd come to dinner with the family because he'd known Maria would be there. Serena had told the world that Maria had a date. He'd known Maria would celebrate their mom's birthday because Serena had posted about that too. As the reality of what was happening sank in, Maria felt a mounting sense of panic that began to take on a life of its own. It was getting harder to catch her breath as the muscles in her chest began to compress. She tried to will the sensations away, and from past experience knew she was having a panic attack. But she kept thinking about Serena. What if they were already too late? What if Dr. Manning had already abducted Serena and would do to her what had been done to Cassie? Maria's mind flashed on the photos from Laws's crime scene, and her lungs suddenly constricted even more, making breathing almost impossible. She told herself again that it was simply a panic attack. But as she tried and failed to draw a breath, she knew that she was mistaken. This wasn't a panic attack. It wasn't like this last time. All at once, she felt a searing pain in her chest that traveled down her left arm. Oh my God, she thought. I'm having a heart attack. Colin hit the brakes and the momentum flung Maria hard into the shoulder harness. She was flung again moments later as he made another turn, her head banging the window. Maria barely registered the pain. All she could think about was the pressure in her chest and the fact that she couldn't breathe. She tried to scream, but no sound came out. In that instant, she was only vaguely aware that her phone had suddenly dinged and vibrated with an incoming text, the thought immediately vanishing as the world began going black at the edges. Maria, what's wrong? Colin called out. Are you okay? I'm having a heart attack. Maria tried to say as her eyes began to close, I'm dying! But the word still wouldn't come. She couldn't breathe. Her heart was giving out. And though she heard Colin calling out her name, it sounded both underwater and far away. And she couldn't understand why Colin wasn't doing anything, why he wasn't helping her. He needed to call an ambulance and rush her to the hospital. Her thoughts were disrupted as she was suddenly shoved upright in her seat and felt pressure on her shoulder. A moment later, her body was being shaken. Take control of this, Maria, Colin commanded. You're having a panic attack.
It's not a panic attack, her mind screamed as she fought for every breath, frantically wondering why he wasn't helping her. It's real this time, can't you see that?
Maria, listen to me, Maria, Colin shouted. I need to know where Serena went. Manning is with her right now. I need your help. Serena needs your help.
Serena. Maria instinctively opened her eyes at the mention of her sister's name and latched on to the sound, focusing on it. But it was too late.
Maria!
This time it was the sound of her own name that jolted her. She thought, Colin is talking to me. She thought, Serena. She thought, Dr. Manning. Somehow she was able to hold her eyes open, though she still couldn't breathe and she was dizzy. But Serena, oh God, Serena needed help.
Every cell in her body continued to hammer its death omen at Maria, drowning out the reality of the situation. She fought to regain clarity. She forced herself to think about Serena and knew they were going to the waterfront to save her sister and that her phone had vibrated with a text. It was all she could do to turn the screen face up and focus, but she was somehow able to make out the words, Sorry, ringer off. Walking to interview now, wish me luck. Serena. Her sister was still alive and they were racing to save her. Maria forced herself to draw a long, steady breath and then another. A panic attack, that's all, she thought. I can get through this. But her body was still rebelling, even if her mind had begun to clear. Her hands shook and her fingers weren't working right. She was able to hit the redial button, but the call went to voicemail. Meanwhile, Colin continued to shout at her from the driver's seat, even as he skidded through another turn. Maria, are you okay? Tell me you're going to be okay. Though it took her a moment, she realized they'd reached South Front Street and were headed in the right direction. I'm okay, she mumbled, still catching her breath, amazed she could speak at all, realizing that breathing was no longer impossible. Just need a minute. Colin quickly glanced over at her before facing forward again, pressing down on the accelerator. How much farther? He asked. I need to know where she is. I don't know, Maria answered, her voice still weak, her body struggling to recover. A few more blocks, she huffed, feeling dizzy. You sure?
Was she? She looked up the street, wanting to make sure.
Yes. On the left or right?
Left. Maria answered, straining. She forced herself to sit higher in the seat. Her body continued to tremble.
Colin sped through the next intersection. Staring out the window, Maria vaguely noticed a half dozen shacks and boathouses closer to the river, looking dark and shadowed. Streetlights barely cut through the darkness. The car's momentum began to decrease as Colin lifted his foot from the accelerator, and they coasted the next block and through another intersection. Here, the architecture immediately shifted. The flat-roofed buildings were now sandwiched together like row houses, some of the buildings in better condition than others. There were office lights blazing on some floors, but most were blackened, and the cars on the street were separated by wider gaps. There was no traffic in either direction. As they drove through another block, the area suddenly began to feel familiar, and Maria knew they were close. Even as she struggled with a sudden rush of anger and guilt she felt for having a panic attack at the worst possible moment, when Serena needed her most. She reminded herself that she'd been here before, and despite her body's continued rebellion, she forced herself to take long breaths as she scanned the buildings. It was hard to tell for sure which was the one they wanted, since she hadn't been paying that much attention the first time she'd come here. She vaguely recalled that Serena had been standing at an intersection, and there'd been some construction workers staring from the opposite side of the street. She squinted, spotted scaffolding on a building at the corner, and then, on the opposite side of the street, Serena's car.
There, she said, pointing, the four-story brick one on the corner.
Colin immediately pulled over, braking hard. He jumped out of the car and took off running, not waiting for Maria as she struggled to open her door. Furious that her body had gone into revolt and needed to recover. She didn't have time for that. Not now, especially not now. Finally pushing the door open, she willed herself to stand and start moving. By then, Colin had already reached the lobby door.
She saw him struggling to open it, finding it locked, then jabbing at something beside the handle. When Maria looked up, there were 7 or 8 offices still illuminated on various floors, and she watched as Colin pounded the glass. She could tell from his body language that he was debating whether to smash his way in, but Maria instinctively knew that Serena wasn't in the office building. Nor was Dr. Manning. He'd been far too careful to this point to make that mistake now. He'd been far too meticulous, and there were too many people in the building. Too many potential witnesses, too many things that could go wrong. She guessed that Dr. Manning had been waiting for Serena on the sidewalk in front of the building, and probably had a story about a pipe that burst or whatever. So the interview would be held elsewhere. She knew that he wanted someplace private, where he knew he wouldn't be caught. A place that would burn.
Colin!
She tried to shout. The sound came out weak. She tried to wave her arms, but the dizziness came back in a rush and she stumbled.
Colin!
She called out again, and this time he heard her voice and ran toward her.
The door has one of those key code locks. There's no listing for the foundation, so I just hit all the buttons, but no one's buzzing.
Serena's not in there, Maria forced out. Manning took her someplace else. There are too many people inside, too many people still working.
If she got in his car?
She texted that she was walking to the interview.
Then where's his car? I don't see it.
Check around the corner,
Maria wheezed, still fighting waves of dizziness.
He probably parked there. If he's looking for someplace deserted, he took her to one of the shacks or boathouses near the river. Hurry,
she said, feeling like she was about to fall over.
Just go. I'll get my phone and call the police.
And my parents, my relatives, Lily, everyone who jumped in their cars to follow us, she thought. By then, Colin was already backing up toward the intersection, uncertain, wanting to trust her, but...
How do you know that's where they'll be?
Because,
she said, wondering when the police would arrive, remembering the lakeside cabin where Cassie had been murdered. Remembering the shacks and boathouses common to this portion of the Cape Fear River.
That's where Laws would have gone.
Chapter 33. Colin. Maria's instincts had been right. He found the blue Camry parked on the cross street that ran beside the building. He sprinted past it. Straight ahead was an unkempt field that stretched toward the muddy banks of the Cape Fear River. A black void ahead of him, barren of reflection on this almost moonless night. The street gave way to a gravel road that forked to the left and right, toward the river's edge. One way led to a small, run-down marina with a rusting metal structure that was home to a hodgepodge of boats, protected by low fencing. In the other direction stood 2 decaying barn-like structures near the riverbank, spaced maybe 50 yards apart. Those buildings looked abandoned, with cracked planks and peeling, faded paint, overgrown weeds and kudzu surrounding them. Colin slowed, frantically trying to guess where Manning had taken Serena. In that instant, he saw a ray of light leaking out intermittently between the planks of the abandoned building on the left, vanishing and reappearing. The beam of a flashlight? He left the gravel cutting through the grass and weeds that were shin-high in places, willing himself to move even faster, hoping he hadn't arrived too late. Still unsure what he was going to do or what he was going to find. As he reached the building where he'd seen the light, he pressed himself flush to the side of the wall. Up close, he realized that the structure had once been an ice house, probably used by fishermen to load blocks of ice into their boats to keep their catch fresh. There was no door on this side of the building, but a boarded-over window emitted a weak and flickering light. He began inching toward the side furthest from the river, hoping to find the door when he heard a scream rip from inside. Serena! The sound galvanized him. He raced around the corner, but the door on that side had been boarded over. He accelerated past it to the third side, seeing another boarded-up window. One option left. He peeked around the corner and immediately spotted the door he'd been looking for. Reaching for the knob, he found it locked. In that instant, he heard Serena cry out again. Stepping back, he drove his heel into the door next to the knob. It was a perfect shot, hard and fast, the frame splintering as the door cracked open.
He kicked again, and it swung fully open. In that split second, he saw Serena tied to a chair in the middle of a dimly lit room, Dr. Manning beside her with a flashlight in his hand. There was the shape of a body in the corner, surrounded by rusting paint cans. Serena's face was bruised and bloodied. Both Serena and Dr. Manning cried out in surprise when Colin burst into the room. A beam of light suddenly hit Colin straight in the eyes. Blinded and disoriented, Colin barreled ahead, reaching out in the direction he'd last seen Dr. Manning. He spread his arms, but Manning had the advantage and sidestepped him. Colin felt the heavy metal flashlight crash into the back of his hand and heard the bone snap. The combination of shock and searing pain kept him from reacting quickly enough. As Serena screamed again, Colin twisted, trying to square his shoulders at Manning, but he was too late. The flashlight smashed into his temple, the sudden impact turning everything black. His body went limp, and his legs buckled. He hit the floor even as his mind was still trying to process what had happened. Instinct and experience urged him to get up quickly, and after years of training, the movements should have been automatic, but his body wouldn't respond. He felt another hard blow to his skull, which shot radiant bursts of agony through his system. His mind was teetering on the edge of coherent thought. He registered nothing other than pain and confusion. Time seemed to shatter and fragment. Above the steady ringing in his ears, he could vaguely hear the sound of someone crying and screaming, begging. A woman's voice, and a man's. Twilight descended and pain broke over him like a wave. The sound of whimpering dimly penetrated his stupor. When he recognized his name, he was finally able to somehow open one eye. The world appeared hazy, nothing but a fog-filled dream. But when he thought he saw Maria tied to a chair, it was enough to allow him to finally comprehend what had happened and where he was. No, not Maria. Serena. But he still couldn't move. Still unable to fully focus, he could distantly make out Dr. Manning as he moved along the far wall. He was holding something red and square in his hands. Colin heard Serena's continued cries, and his nostrils were suddenly flooded with the odor of gasoline. It took a moment to put everything together. Dully, he watched Manning toss the gas can aside. Colin saw a flicker of light, a match, and watched it arc toward the ground. He heard the whoop of ignition, like lighter fluid on charcoal. He saw flames begin leaping at the walls, the old planks as dry as tinder. Heat began to rise. Smoke thickened. He tried to move his hands, tried to move his legs, but felt only numb paralysis. His mouth tasted metallic and coppery, and he saw a blur of movement as Manning ran past him toward the door that Colin had kicked in. The flames were reaching toward the ceiling, Serena's cries telegraphing pure terror. He heard her cough once, and then again. Colin willed himself to move and wondered why his body wasn't working. Finally, his left arm began to inch forward, then his right. He slid both arms under him and tried to rise, but his broken hand bones shifted. Colin screamed and his chest hit the floor, pain twisting his anger into rage, fueling his need for violence and revenge. He got to all fours and slowly managed to stand. He felt dizzy, his balance still off. He took a step and stumbled, his eyes stinging in the acrid smoke, tearing up. Serena's cries had turned to uncontrollable coughing. Colin felt as though he couldn't breathe at all. The flames had spread to the other walls surrounding them. The heat was intense, the smoke becoming black, searing his lungs. Colin stumbled the couple of steps it took to reach Serena, and eyed the ragged macrame jungle of rope binding her to the chair. He knew that with one hand, there was no way to untie the rope in time, and he scanned his surroundings, hoping to see a knife, an axe, anything sharp. Colin heard a loud crack, followed by a roar, as the roof of the ice house suddenly sagged, sending sparks in all directions. A rafter beam crashed within a few feet of them, then another fell even closer. Along three walls, flames seemed to multiply, the heat so intense that Colin felt as if his clothing had ignited.
Beginning to panic, he grabbed the chair with Serena still in it and heaved, feeling a burst of pain in his broken hand. His mind flashed white, and it fueled the rage inside him. He could handle pain. He knew how to harness it and tried to draw on it, but his hand would no longer grip. Unable to carry Serena, he had no other option. There were 5, maybe 6 strides to the door, and grabbing the back of her chair with his good hand, he spun it around and began dragging it toward the doorway. He needed to get there before the flames did. He tugged and dragged, every jerk sending pain through his hand and his head. He burst through the open doorway. Smoke and heat followed them out, and he knew he needed to get Serena a safe distance away from the smoke. He couldn't drag her through the field or the mud, and spotting gravel to the right, he went that direction, toward the other building. Behind them, the ice house was nearly engulfed in flames. The sound rose in volume, magnifying the continued ringing in his ears. He kept moving, resting only when the heat from the fire began to diminish. Serena hadn't stopped coughing, and in the darkness, her skin looked almost blue. He knew she needed an ambulance. She needed oxygen, and he still had to get her out of the chair. He saw nothing he could use to cut the rope, and he wondered if there might be something in the other building. Just as he started toward it, he saw a figure step out from the corner and move into firing position. The barrel of a gun reflected the fire. The shotgun Margolis had mentioned, the one Manning had said might not even work. Colin knocked Serena and the chair over and dove to block her in the same instant he heard the explosion. The shotgun had been fired from 40 yards, pushing the maximum range, and Manning's aim had been high. The second shot was slightly more accurate. Colin felt the pellets tear through his shoulder and upper back, blood spilling. He went dizzy again, fighting to remain conscious as he blearily watched Manning start running for his car. There was no way Colin could catch him. Manning's figure receded and there was nothing Colin could do. He wondered why it was taking so long for the police to arrive and hoped they'd catch him. His thoughts were interrupted by a roar as fire suddenly mushroomed through the roof of the ice house, alive and screaming, the sound almost deafening. Part of the wall exploded, sending burning pieces of wooden sparks in their direction. He could barely hear Serena crying through her coughs, and he realized they were still in danger, too close to the fire. There was no way Colin could drag her farther, but he could get help, and he forced himself to rise. He needed to get to a place where someone would see him. He staggered forward a few dozen steps, losing blood, his left arm and hand now useless, his nerve endings radiating agony. By then, Manning had reached his car, and Colin saw the headlights flash on. The Camry tore away from the curb, heading directly toward him and toward Serena. Colin knew he couldn't outrun the car. No way he could so much as dodge it. But Serena was even more helpless, and Manning knew exactly where she was. Gritting his teeth, Colin staggered forward as fast as he could, creating distance between him and Serena, hoping Manning would follow him, hoping Manning would flee. But the headlights remained aimed in Serena's direction. Not knowing what else to do, Colin stopped and began waving his right arm, trying to draw Manning's attention. He flipped Manning the bird. The Camry immediately veered away from Serena and toward Colin, accelerating and closing the distance. The ice house continued to emit an eerie, high-pitched shriek as fire consumed it. Colin staggered as fast as he could away from Serena, knowing he had only a few more seconds, knowing he was about to die. The car was almost upon him when all at once, the ground in front of him was bathed in another set of headlights racing up from somewhere behind him. He barely saw the blur of Evan's Prius as it crashed into the Camry with ear-splitting force, pushing both cars toward the fire. The Camry smashed into the corner of the ice house, the Prius bulldozing it forward. The roof of the building began to collapse as flames leaped farther upward toward the sky. Colin tried to rush forward, but his legs gave out. Blood continued to pulse from his wounds, and as he lay on the ground, he could feel himself growing dizzy again. He could hear sirens now, competing with the sound of the fire. He suspected they were too late, that he wouldn't survive. But that didn't matter to him.
He couldn't take his eyes from the Prius, and he watched for the door to open or for the window to go down. Evan and Lily could escape the fire if they moved fast, but the chances of that happening were slim. He had to get to them and tried again to rise. Lifting his head nearly caused him to black out. He thought he saw swirling red and blue lights on the side streets and bright headlights moving closer. He heard panicked voices calling out for Serena and for him, and he wanted to shout at them that they should hurry, that Evan and Lily needed help, but all that came out was a raspy whisper. He heard Maria then, heard as she screamed his name and reached his side.
"I'm here," she cried. "Hold on, the ambulance is coming."
Even then, Colin couldn't answer. Everything had begun to spin, and images became disjointed, nothing making sense. In one instant, the Prius was swallowed whole by flames. When he blinked again, only half of the car was gone. He thought he saw the passenger door creak open, but there was too much smoke, and there were no other signs of movement, and he couldn't be sure. He felt himself slipping away, darkness settling in. And in his last moment of consciousness, he prayed that the two best friends he'd ever known would somehow make it out alive.
Epilogue. April never ceased to surprise Maria. Though she'd grown up in the South and knew what to expect, there were always a few glorious days, perfect days, when it seemed as though anything were possible. Cloudless blue skies would greet green lawns that had been brown all winter, and everything would suddenly explode with color. Dogwoods and cherry trees and azaleas would burst into life throughout the city, while tulips sprang forth from carefully tended gardens. Mornings were cool, but the days would warm up as the sun rose bright in the sky. Today was one of those ephemeral spring days. And as Maria stood on the carefully tended lawn, she could see Serena chatting animatedly with a group of people Maria didn't recognize, the smile on her face wide and joyful. Seeing her now, it was hard to believe that until recently, Serena had struggled to smile at all. She'd suffered nightmares about her ordeal for months, and when she looked in the mirror, she'd seen bruises and cuts Manning had inflicted while she'd been tied to the chair. Two of the cuts had left scars, one near her eye, the other on her jawline, but they were already beginning to fade. In another year, Maria doubted anyone would notice them at all, unless they knew exactly where to look. But that would also mean they would have to remember that horrible night. And with those memories, there was always pain. It had been 2 weeks before Detective Wright, along with a still recuperating Pete Margolis, had met with Maria and admitted that Colin had been right about everything. The remains of Atkinson's body were found in what was left of the burned-out ice house. Ballistics testing eventually connected the bullet in Atkinson's head to the gun that had been in Lester's possession. The fire made it impossible to determine exactly when he'd been killed, though investigators suspected that it was around the time he'd vanished. They were able to determine that his body had been stored in a large, otherwise empty freezer in Dr. Manning's garage in Charlotte, thanks to a few strands of Atkinson's hair found frozen to the sides. Research into Manning's bank accounts showed numerous cash disbursements, the numbers matching the amounts that had been transferred into Atkinson's accounts to pay his bills, and also confirmed the rental of the bungalow in Shallotte. Lester's fingerprints had been found in Atkinson's car, and investigators had hoped that Lester would provide even more answers. It was not to be. After spending 3 days in the infirmary under constant supervision, he was evaluated by a psychiatrist and deemed fit to be returned to a cell, subject to frequent monitoring. Later that afternoon, Lester met with his attorney, who reported that Lester, though heavily medicated and shaken by the loss of his father, seemed fairly lucid. Lester agreed to be interviewed by detectives the following day, as long as his attorney was present. He was returned to his cell and finished the tray of food that had been brought to him. Video recordings indicated that guards checked on him every 15 to 20 minutes. But Lester nonetheless managed to hang himself, using strips from the bed sheet that he'd tied together. By the time the guards found him, it was too late. Maria wondered sometimes whether Lester had truly been an accomplice or was simply another victim of Dr. Manning's. Or maybe even both. Pete Margolis admitted after he woke from his coma that he was unsure who had shot him. Dr. Manning had called out, telling him to come in, but Margolis saw only a brief glimpse of a gun barrel poking through the gap in a closet door before he was hit. The only thing Maria knew for sure was that Lester and Dr. Manning were both dead, and neither would ever come for her again. But despite what they'd done to her and to Serena, she sometimes felt flashes of grief and pity for the Manning family. A young son who died in an accident, an older sister murdered, a mother long struggling with depression who committed suicide. She wondered who she would have become had those things happened to her, or had Serena died that night in the ice house. Glancing over her shoulder, she surveyed the crowd that had gathered on the lawn and silently counted her blessings. Her mom and dad were managing to keep their protective instincts in check. Her job with Jill was hugely satisfying, and she'd used some of her severance package to refurnish her condo and buy a new wardrobe, and still had enough left over to start building a small nest egg. Last weekend, she'd even wandered into a camera shop and fallen in love with a wildly expensive UV lens. The water was warming too, her paddleboard calling to her. The wedding had been spectacular, though with Lily directing and stage managing, Maria had expected nothing less. While Wilmington would always be home, Maria could see that Charleston definitely had its charms. Lily was ethereal in her wedding dress, a confection of floating satin, tiny sea pearls, and fragile lace. Evan had been dreamy-eyed as he stared at her during their vows at St. Michael's Church. The oldest religious structure in Charleston, it was the preferred wedding venue for the more aristocratic families of Charleston. But when Lily drawled,
"Why, I simply can't imagine why anyone would want to be married anywhere else,"
she somehow made it sound logical and sincere, rather than snobbish. On that awful night, Lily had miraculously escaped unharmed. Evan had been less fortunate, however. He'd emerged with second-degree burns on his back and a couple of broken bones in his leg. He'd been in a cast for nearly 2 months and had only recently begun walking without a limp again, in part due to his new exercise regime. His workouts weren't quite up to Colin's standards, but he'd confided to Maria later that he'd been putting extra work in on his arms and was hoping Lily would notice on their honeymoon to the Bahamas. They'd both had angels on their shoulders. Maria believed that as she'd seen Lily and Evan emerge from the Prius, and though some people might laugh at the notion, she didn't care. She knew. Behind her, the wedding reception was in full swing, solemnity finally giving way to festivities. Lily had wanted the reception held at her parents' spacious second home on the banks of the Ashley River, and as far as Maria could tell, no expense had been spared. A palatial white tent glowed with elaborately strung lights, and guests were dancing on a parquet floor before a 10-piece band. The food had been catered by one of the finest restaurants in the city, and the spring flower arrangements were works of art. Maria knew she'd never have a wedding like this. It wasn't her style. As long as she had her friends and family, and maybe a couple of piñatas later for the younger guests, she would be happy. Not that she was thinking of getting married in the near future. The subject had yet to come up, and Maria had no intention of asking Colin about it directly. In most ways, Colin hadn't changed at all. He'd tell her the truth, and she wasn't sure she was ready to hear the answer. She might be inclined to hint if the opportunity presented itself, but even the thought of that sometimes made her nervous. Colin had only recently managed to resume his workout routine, but he was sometimes frustrated he wasn't able to do the things he used to do, including MMA training. He needed at least another 6 months, the doctors insisted. The shotgun blast had torn through part of his shoulder muscle, leaving vivid scars and a weakness that might be permanent. He'd already undergone one operation on his hand, and another was planned in a few more months. The injury that concerned the doctors most, however, had been the skull fracture, and he'd spent 4 days in the ICU, near Pete Margolis. Margolis had been the first one to speak to Colin when he regained consciousness,
They tell me you saved my life, Margolis had said to him. But don't think this changes anything about your deal. I'm still going to keep an eye on you.
Okay, Colin had managed to croak out.
They also tell me that Dr. Manning beat the crap out of you, and that Evan ended up being the one who finally took him out. I find that very hard to imagine.
Okay, Colin said again.
My wife said you came to check on me. Said you were polite, too. And that my friend Larry apparently thinks you're pretty smart.
His throat dry, Colin merely grunted this time. Margolis shook his head and sighed.
Do me a favor and stay out of trouble.
And one more thing.
He finally cracked a smile.
Thank you.
Since then, Margolis hadn't dropped by to check on Colin, even once. Maria sensed Colin's approach and then felt his arm settle around her. She leaned into him.
There you are, he said. I was looking for you.
It's so beautiful by the water, she said. She turned, slipping her arms around him.
Maria, he whispered into her hair, would you do something for me?
When she pulled back and looked at him quizzically, he went on.
I'd like you to meet my parents.
Her eyes widened.
They're here? Why didn't you tell me earlier?
I wanted to talk to them first, see where we stand.
And? They're good people.
I told them about you. They asked if they could meet you, but I said I'd have to check with you first.
Of course I'll meet your parents. Why would you have to check with me?
I wasn't sure what else to say. I've never introduced them to a girl before.
Never? Wow. That makes me feel pretty special.
It should. You are.
So, let's go meet your parents. Since I'm so special and you're crazy about me and you probably can't imagine living without me. In fact, you just might be thinking that I'm the one, right?
He smiled, his eyes never leaving hers.
Okay.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of See Me, written by Nicholas Sparks, read by Christopher Ryan Grant, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by Jared O'Connell, sound editing by Ryan Lissy, post-production by Beat Street Productions. See Me is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Willow Holdings Incorporated. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.